Letters to Daniel, Volume 2. Letter 6-8. Audiobooks. Printed and posted in the year of Christ our King, 2012. In the second month, on the first day of the second month.
This book might be confusing to some, but keep in mind, throughout my book, that this was a very confusing world I lived in. I think to truly begin to understand what it was like, you would have had to be there. And since I wish that on no one, this book is my attempt to convey the overwhelming confusion I felt during those years and to begin to unravel the damage that was done to me and my family. You might be suddenly hearing about a character that was never introduced, but that's how it was for me. It didn't feel like a sequence of events. Even after I was freed, moments are fragmented and jumbled. With some help, I have come to realize that my perspective is unique to abduction. I don't want to lose that voice, and therefore I have written this book how it came to me naturally. I'm not the average storyteller. I'm me, and my experience is very uncommon. Yes, I jump around with tangents, but that's sometimes the way my mind works. If you want a less confusing story, come back to me in 10 years from now when I sort it all out.
Had I walked by 1859 Geary Boulevard in San Francisco when People's Temple was in full swing, I certainly would have been drawn to the doorway. I grew up in a conservative Christian family with an adopted black brother. Race and religion were the dominant themes of my childhood. In our small Indiana town, David and I often felt self-conscious walking down the street together. Strangers scowled at us and sometimes called us names. I wrote about the challenges of our relationship in my memoir, Jesus Land. Suffice it to say, David and I would have been thrilled and amazed by People's Temple, a church where blacks and whites worshiped side by side, the preacher taught social justice instead of damnation, and the gospel choir transported the congregation to a loftier realm. We longed for such a place.
Dear Dan, after the iPod victory, during my subsequent writing of these letters, I listened to two audiobooks, also available in print, at work. I learned about one from hearing the author being interviewed on Coast to Coast AM, and the other from a TV show that interviews victims of crimes. The latter was the first book I listened to. It is called A Stolen Life, a Memoir, and is read by the author J.C. Lee Dugard, herself also the victim of the crime. The second book I listened to is called A Thousand Lives by Julia Shears and is about the People's Temple, Jonestown, Jim Jones, and the followers that died with him. While listening to the first book, I was put into the shoes of the victim, J.C., and the criminal, Philip Garrido. This was not easy, because it was not the yoke of Christ, but the bondage of Satan I experienced while interceding. The second book, the one about Jonestown, was informative and was also burdensome, but in a different way. Mr. Jones has passed away, so there is no longer any prayer, intercessory or otherwise, possible for him. But there were certain statements made by him, as quoted by the author, that the Lord highlighted to me as I listened. Here is the first quote. I love socialism, and I'm willing to die to bring it about. But if I did, I'd take 1,000 with me. Jim Jones, September 6, 1975. Here is the second quote. So you want to die, huh? Touche asked. Go ahead and kill me because I'd rather be dead than be here, Stanley answered. When Jones saw that Stanley wasn't intimidated, he told Touche to lower the weapon. Stanley repeated his defense that he was unjustly accused. He didn't have sex with Ellen, and Jones switched gears. You should never oppose the office, he told Stanley in a confiding tone, or others will follow suit. He made a deal with Stanley. He'd take Janice and him off learning crew if Stanley acted scared when they returned to the pavilion, as if they'd roughed him up. Stanley agreed. And the third quote. It was now an offense to even utter the words, "I want to go home." Daniel Gardfrey, 13, was assigned to the learning crew for doing so, and Jones warned Mary Baldwin, 52, that she'd be condemned to a hospital bed for saying she didn't like Jonestown. Residents sized up the jungle and their chances of getting through it alive. Sometimes I feel like getting away from it all, Brenda Warren, 16, wrote Jones. I walk by the bush and say I could just leave, but I don't really have the courage as I say I do. Edith Roller knew better than to ask to leave. She was particularly annoyed by the tedious rallies, and after one meeting that lasted from dusk until dawn, she wrote Jones a memo suggesting ways to expedite them. When she showed the note to one of Jones' secretaries, however, the woman warned her not to criticize the office, so she threw it away. That did not stop her from keeping a thorough accounting of the problems riddling the settlement in her journal. The two terms in these quotes that the Lord wanted me to think about were socialism and the office. Dan, the next few paragraphs presuppose a demonic network over and through Jim Jones and his delegates. At least as far as Jones went and the people of Jonestown, the demons loved their brand of socialism as it made it very easy to manipulate and control their enterprise, until someone, Stanley, was willing to take a stand even if it meant sacrificing his own life. Then the demons backed down. Jones changed course at once in that the demonic courage that powered him diminished in the face of true courage. He and his demons then immediately went into manipulation mode and negotiated with Stanley to assist in their deception. More than anything, the demons wanted to protect the office, that is, the authority of the man, in this case Jim Jones, and the gifts of God poured out upon him, given to him without repentance. Jones had been compromised early in his life and apparently never recovered. But even in his final state, perhaps he could have repented and been saved before dying. God knows, I do not. Blessings. Romanus Theophilus.